Hi everybody, today's Friday, August 1st, 2025, and our friend Ambassador Chas Freeman is back with us. Welcome back, Ambassador.
Very glad to be with you.
Today's talk, Ambassador, is dedicated to Amir, who was murdered in Gaza by IDF. And we've learned this story, his story, and there was an interview with Tucker Carlson and the U.S. Green Beret Colonel Anthony Aguilar. He mentioned he talked with this guy and he know what has happened to him. Here is what he said. It's a long video, but this interview is so important because this part is so important. I hope whoever is watching us right now goes and see the interview that he had with Tucker Carlson.
The full interview, yes.
Full interview, yeah.
Right.
Here is what he said, Ambassador.
I didn't get this secondhand. I didn't see it from afar and then assume I saw it. I touched it. I felt it. Other people saw it. This young little boy. His name is Amir. I know that because when he walked over from the crowd of people, he walked toward me. There was two of us standing there, two UG Solutions guards standing in that area. And he was walking towards us and we thought maybe he was hurt or maybe he was asking for some more food because all he had in his arms was a small bag of rice, half a bag of flour, some lentils that he had picked up from the ground. He didn't have much. And we thought maybe he was asking for more food or maybe he was hurt. And we notioned him over and he came up and he extends his right hand at us. And so I kind of walked up to him and waved him over. And the guy standing next to me, this young boy, holds his hand and he kisses it. And then he comes to me and he holds my hand and he kisses it. In Arab culture, that is a very significant sign of respect. That's not something that should be taken lightly or something that should be, that's a big sign of respect. And we were taken aback by that. The gentleman that was standing next to me was also a military veteran, combat veteran. So he's been to Afghanistan, Iraq, and he was moved by it. He was touched. I was touched. And as he was standing there, we were both looking at him and he was very emaciated. He had no shoes on. His pants were tattered. He had a kind of a rope or string holding his pants up. Filthy. Probably hasn't bathed in months. Probably hasn't eaten in days. And oh, by the way, when they walk 8 to 12 kilometers to get to these sites, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation mechanism provides no water. Zero. Not a single bottle. Because it's too expensive. Distributing water weighs so much that it breaks down the profit per cost per truck. That's a fact, because I asked why, and I was given a lesson in it. This is why. It's too expensive, so we give them no water. All of their food, by the way, requires water to cook it. Rice, lentils, beans, flour, you gotta have water. So what we're giving them, I don't know how they're eating it, but he's standing there and I put my arm on his left shoulder, and I look at him and I can feel the bones in his shoulder. I can feel the weakness in his arm. I can feel the vulnerability. I can feel the desperation. And I look at him and I got down on my knees where I'm looking at him in the eyes. And then I say to him, I said, people care. America cares. You're not going to be forgotten. People in the world care. And he doesn't speak English and I don't speak Arabic. But the connection we had in looking at each other, he felt for the first time in a long time that there was someone that cared. And I got down on a knee and he came and to his level and the items he had in his hand, he sets them down on the ground and he raises his hands and they're small, fragile. You can see bones sticking, just the bones through the skin. And he places his hands on my face and he kissed me. And he looked at me in the eyes and he says, thank you. He said it in English. Thank you. Like, people are starving in Gaza. People are dying in Gaza. These children that are starving and dying, these children, they look like everyday Americans. This child is picking up noodles off the ground with his bare hands because there was no food left. So he's picking up noodles to put into his backpack. Amir goes back to the main group, and he goes out the exit. We had a very strict protocol that they come in a certain way, get the aid, and then they go out a certain way. From the way they came in, it takes them back to the way they came in. The exit takes them back that same way. So they enter from the Maraw corridor. They go south. They go through the station. They exit and they go north to the Maraw corridor. So coming in and going out, they're tied right back into the active combat zone. Site number two particularly is a little bit different than the other sites because it's in between site one and two. And there's an IDF combat outpost just off the corner of SDS-2. So there's a berm that lines that road going out. So if people are leaving the exit and someone is on the east side of the berm shooting into the crowd over here, you can't see what's on the other side of that berm because of the obscuration, the field of fire. So the IDF are shooting at the crowd that's leaving. As the crowd left and they would hit the Maraw corridor to go west, the IDF would shoot at them, shoot at their feet, shoot over their head. We would shoot at them, shoot at their feet, shoot over their head, shoot into the air. And the bullets start hitting off the ground. There's video of this. It's on the BBC video. Hitting off the ground, see dirt flying up. And I was still on the site. I was below the berm. It was the second time we had done distribution. So when I heard the gunfire kick off, the automatic machine gun fire, I thought we were under attack. I thought something had happened. So I ran up to the southern berm and I laid down to take cover. You know, I'm observing and I'm looking and I see the shooting keep going on, like just the rap and Palestinians dropping on the side of the road. So Amir didn't make it home. He walked 12 kilometers to get some food, picked up scraps off the ground. That's all that was left because the 8-minute mayhem took all of the food. And by the time he got there, walking with no shoes, hungry and tired, the only thing left for him was to pick up some remnants off the ground. And when he left, he was killed by the IDF. Why? Because they lack discipline, they lack standards, and they lack basic human decency. Now, do I think that they intentionally shot him or shot the people they were shooting at? No. But when you use machine guns and tank rounds and mortar rounds to control a crowd, what do you think is going to happen? And the United States stands by and watches it. As in the press conference that GHF gave last night, will the IDF shoot to control the crowd? We only shoot at the crowd in the air around them or at their feet. We don't shoot into them. Unacceptable behavior. That is not how professionals behave when dealing with a civilian population. You use things like signs. What I thought would be another great, great tool would have been a loudspeaker with a microphone with an interpreter. Because no one there speaks Arabic and they don't speak English. So when you're dealing with a crowd of 8,000 to 9,000 people and you're trying to communicate with them, and I was like, how about before we start shooting, how about we do two things? One, we provide a loudspeaker with a translator. Two, we put signage. We put signs out there that say, go this way, go that way, turn left. They don't know where they're going. They don't live here. It's a war zone. So the only way I could describe the sites is death traps. And they didn't become death traps. They were designed as death traps. And the United States puts aid and we lure them in. And when they leave, they get shot at coming and they get shot at going. So the reports you hear from Nasser Hospital, which is about 5 kilometers from site number two, Nasser Hospital, that you hear all the reports of dead civilians coming in to get treated. The doctors have said this is grotesque. Doctors have testified that every time GHF does a distribution at site 1, 2, or 3, which the road from those goes directly to the Nasser Hospital, they get a massive influx of patients to what they call mass casualties, an MCI, mass casualty incident, every time.
Have you ever heard of any other country do it? I've never heard of anything like this, but I haven't spent 25 years deployed in war zones. I just want...
I've never seen it.
You've never seen this anywhere.
Anywhere to this scale. Now, in other countries that I've been in with partnered forces, are there sometimes an errant or undisciplined, you know, bad apple in the group that you discipline and you correct that behavior? I've seen that. At this scale, to where it's widely accepted, but then to also the fact that the UG solutions contractors also do it under the guise of, well, the IDF do it, so we're fine with doing it. Never, Never have I seen an American behave this way. Never have I seen an army. And I, you know, I've seen some pretty ragtag armies in my day. And never have I seen this level of depravity and just disrespect for human dignity. And it's, I mean, the word I keep using because it's the only way I can describe it is because America is giving tax dollars to it. It's un-American.
You're muted.
What he said, I think, shows the gravity of what's going on in Gaza. And I don't know who, is there anybody in the Trump administration or anybody caring about a American colonel going there and saying this story, that what's going on in Gaza?
I don't know. That was an incredibly moving segment from the Tucker Carlson interview. And God bless Colonel Aguilar for his honesty and his decency, which caused him to leave the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation and go public with what he had observed. It's still going on. But he made a crucial observation, and that is that these so-called feeding stations were designed as death traps. They are actually configured like the stockyard partitions that lead cattle to the slaughter. And of course, one has to recognize also that Israel has accomplished one thing in Gaza, and that is it has destroyed law and order, which was enforced by Hamas. Hamas ensured that there was discipline. It may have been somewhat favoritist in its distribution of food, but there's no real evidence of that. It appears to have maintained order long past the moment when any other population might have collapsed into anarchy. And anarchy is what we now have. People are so desperate for food, for water, for medical care, that they are completely wild. And so when trucks, occasionally Israel allows a truck over the border, usually these days it is mobbed by hungry people, and everything is stripped out of it, including, I'm told, occasionally things like the batteries and other components of the truck. People are at the point where they are desperate. There are people in Israel who remember this kind of thing, although fewer and fewer of them. It's exactly what happened in the Warsaw Ghetto. The Nazis doing this to Jews. So I continue to find it incredible that apparently 85% of Israelis approve of what is being done by these members of their armed forces in Gaza, and seem to have no conscience, no remorse. And I think the long-term implications of this are many. One is that they are discrediting the entire Jewish population in the world, because they claim they are the bastion of Judaism. I think actually they are they dishonor that religion by their behavior. Judaism is a religion that emphasizes the pursuit of justice and ethical reasoning through scholarship. Jews traditionally are charitable, kind to their, not just to their other Jews, but to other people. They are an important part of Western societies. In the United States, there's a larger Jewish population than there is in Israel. And they are the most admired religious group in the country for good reason. All of that is being jeopardized. It is being threatened by the what Israel has done is not only destroy its own moral standing, but that of its supporters abroad, many of whom are Jewish. Of course, some of the most outspoken opponents of Israeli policies are Jewish, And I think they deserve praise for their honesty and their decency, their willingness to stand up and condemn what is being done in their name. So that's the first thing. Second, of course, the United States, as Colonel Aguilar indicated, is not just complicit, we are a full participant in this genocide. He mentioned American mercenary members of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation saying, well, if the Israelis can shoot people, so can we. This is a joined at the hip operation that is entirely evil. It is not aimed at feeding people or saving their lives. It's aimed at annihilating them or immiserating them to the point where they can be forcibly removed from Gaza so that Jewish settlement can recommence. So I think Colonel Aguilar has done a great service, not just to himself and to Americans, to the world, I think also potentially to Israel, because I hope people in Israel will watch this. And they are basically cut off from any firsthand knowledge of what is happening and what is being done by their armed forces in Gaza. There are some Israeli politicians, former Prime Minister Olmert comes to mind, who have been sufficiently honest and forthright to condemn the violence in the West Bank and to call what is happening in Gaza by its proper name, which is genocide, and to be ashamed as Jews, as victims of genocide, that their country has lost its status as a victim. Israelis are no longer seen by the world as victims. They are seen as perpetrators of genocide, of mass murder. They are seen as sadistic in a way that no one could have possibly imagined. If you recall the video postings of Israeli soldiers in Gaza, mocking women and mocking the dead and stealing toys and jewelry and doing it all on camera. Look at how we've managed to put the Palestinians down, humiliate them. So this is, as you said, Nima, this is an important, very important video, deserves to be widely seen in Israel as well as abroad. It's difficult not to cry when you see it.
Yeah. Basil, you've mentioned how the world is changing, and we see that with the case of European countries coming out. They want to recognize the state of Palestine. Canada is talking about it. And, you know, it's not about the leaders who have suddenly decided to do this. It's about the public opinion, how the world, the public opinion in the world is forcing the leaders to do something for Gaza.
Well, I don't think this is aimed at doing anything for the Palestinians. It is politically fraudulent. First of all, if there was a time to recognize a two-state solution and support Palestinian self-determination, it was years ago, before Israel gobbled up most of the land, before it began its genocide in Gaza. So this is too little too late. It may not even be feasible. So in September, when Canada, New Zealand, and others join France, Germany, and the UK in recognizing a Palestinian state, that won't create self-determination for Palestinians. What it is, and the way to look at it, is it's a politically dishonest way of punishing Israel for its behavior. It is correctly seen by Israelis as a slap in the face, but that's all. And it is therefore in the grand tradition of the Western approach to affairs in West Asia, namely, a lot of lofty talk and no action, or very pathetic inaction, beneath the lofty talk. So I'm not as impressed by this as Keir Starmer thinks I should be. And I agree with you. The fundamental issue is that public opinion is becoming aware of what Israel now represents. And what it represents is a sadomasochist country, a country with no morality at all, and no regard for human life other than that of its own people, its own families. So this issue is presented globally in the Western press as about the hostage release, as though there weren't many, many thousands of Palestinian hostages being mistreated terribly in Israeli penal facilities. We've actually had the Israelis going on television advocating sodomy, rape of male prisoners. We know that female prisoners are raped. We know that people are denied medical care, that they are denied food, they are starved to death. We have many documented cases of this. Israeli human rights organization, like B'Tselem, the most famous of them, have finally been forced to recognize that what is happening is genocide and to condemn it. There are people of conscience in Israel, even if they are ever fewer, because those with their conscience are emigrating. They don't want to be part of what they are now a part of. So this is a tragedy for everybody, including Israelis, who are at least the European component of your Israelis, are victims of a terrible human rights atrocities in Europe. Now, here I would note that, of course, a lot of Israelis are not European. They are Arab. There are even some Persian Israelis. I mentioned to you that I like Mohsen Yaganeh. I now have seen an Israeli Persian performance of his song, complete with very attractive dancing girls and so forth. Persian Jewish diaspora apparently is alive and well. Fine, that's well and good. Anyway, the point is, Israeli society, the people who had to move to Israel from Arab countries, from Muslim countries, moved there not because they were subjected to anti-Semitism. Oh, they were a minority. Yes, it's always uncomfortable to be a minority. I have been a minority. I think you are a minority, both in Iran and in Brazil. That's always uncomfortable. But they were not being persecuted. When Israel was formed, Israel actually took actions, false flag operations, to scare Arab Jews into feeling that they had to flee to Israel to gain the population. And so they have replaced what is basically an amicable relationship between Jews and Muslims, much more amicable than between Jews and Christians, with a myth that somehow Islam is anti-Semitic in its nature. Of course, the Quran does record struggles, political struggles in Arabia between Jewish and non-Jewish tribes, but that is not evidence of anti-Semitism. And in fact, my experience as ambassador in Saudi Arabia was that the austere version of Islam that prevailed there had no real contradictions with Judaism. There were many Jews who quietly practiced their religion on their own. They didn't do it in public because of the opprobrium that attaches to Israel. But Christians had a problem because when the Swiss ambassador with his flag with a cross on it drove around in Riyadh, people said, "Oh, this is the Crusaders, you know, they're back again." And so they attacked his car on occasion because it wasn't wasn't Jews who attacked Salahuddin or others in Palestine. It was Christians. Anyway, this is all very complicated, and it's all been overlaid with total lies and deceptions. And I return to the fact that I think Colonel Aguilar has earned a place in heaven for speaking honestly about what is really happening.
We had Steve Witkoff meeting with Netanyahu. It seems that they're trying to disarm Hamas in Gaza. I don't know if Hamas knows the reality of what's going on, and how can they see this sort of attitude on the part of Israelis, and then and somehow it's somehow delusional that you think that Hamas would disarm.
It may disarm under certain circumstances. But I think what we've seen, the Israelis have accomplished a number of things. First, they've definitively demonstrated that Hamas was an effective government in Gaza. It kept order. It kept people fed. It kept water going despite Israeli efforts to destroy it. And the removal of Hamas has created anarchy. So Israel, in a sense, has achieved its objective of removing Hamas from a position of control in Gaza. It has not defeated Hamas militarily, because Israelis still continue to be ambushed and so forth. The hostages are still in Hamas's hands, or the corpses of the hostages. Israel has failed completely on the military level, and it has been driven to genocide. But let's remember why Hamas attacked Israel why it erupted from the Gaza concentration camp on October 7th. Its purpose was to resurrect the Palestinian self-determination issue, to put that back before the world public. And it has succeeded. So you are seeing now governments forced by their people to at least pay lip service to Palestinian self-determination. Of course, lip service is not enough. And one wonders at what point people around the world will demand actual action. There are a number of things, important things happening. One is the joint French-Saudi initiative, which created a declaration, which is now circulating at the United Nations to receive other sponsors, aiming for the September UN General Assembly, when Western countries, apparently, other than the United States, even Canada, even New Zealand, perhaps Australia, will recognize the Palestinian state and vote for its admission to the UN. So this is an important initiative. I think President Macron, who is part of this, may have started it for domestic political purposes, but he's been carried along by the reactions to what Israel is doing, which are ever more negative and disapproving.
Yeah. We know the other part of the issue is the conflict with Iran. Steve Witkoff, as the Iranian foreign minister mentioned, Steve Witkoff is trying to somehow restart the talks between the two parties. It doesn't seem to be in the mind of Iranians. It doesn't seem to be a viable choice if they don't understand the Iranian red line, which would be the enrichment of uranium.
I think Mr. Witkoff, who has just been in Israel, meeting with the accused war criminal, Prime Minister Netanyahu, and then carrying out a propagandistic tour with our ambassador, an evangelical Christian who is a convinced Zionist, of the so-called feeding stations in Gaza, where they tried to show something quite different from what Colonel Aguilar described, which is the reality. This is a propaganda stunt. It's widely regarded in the region as political theater and nothing else. Nothing will come of it. The demand that Hamas commits suicide surrender is obviously not acceptable. I'll return to that. But Mr. Witkoff is off to Moscow, presumably to meet again with President Putin. I don't think he has any credibility at all now, because every negotiation he's been involved in has turned out to be a deception, not serious. That is the case with Iran. And if the terms you are demanding are obviously non-negotiable, you're basically asking for the surrender of Iran to an American position, which is, in fact, an Israeli position, disguised as an American position. This is going to go nowhere. So we have Iran and Israel, I think, preparing for another round of combat. And I don't think the Iranians will be as restrained at all if it happens again. They were somewhat restrained even in the 12-day war. And some of what they did, like striking a radome at Al-Udeid Air Base in Qatar, was performative, not intended not to hurt anybody. But I don't think that will be the case next time around. Iran suffered many civilian casualties. It will inflict many casualties on Israel. It won't just aim at military bases and ports and other infrastructure as it did in the 12-day war. So the question of Hamas disarming itself, however, is not unrealistic. Hamas has actually offered to do that in return for a peace. And it has, of course, despite its charter, it has declared that it will recognize the two-state solution, meaning it will recognize Israel. Not happily, no, reluctantly, but it is realistic. And we confront a problem that is common to all of these issues, and that is that instead of listening to what our opponents say they want or what they actually want, we impute motives to them. So we think President Putin wants to conquer all of Europe, even though he can't advance very fast in Ukraine. We suspect that Iran wants to destroy Israel rather than reach an accommodation with it. You know, Iranians had perfectly good relations with Israel in previous periods. And there is the story of Esther and Cyrus the Great as part of the history between Iranians and Jews. There's nothing written that says that Iran and Israel couldn't have a decent relationship if Israel were prepared to recognize the rights of Palestinians and its immediate neighbors, which it's not. So we impute motives to Iran that it doesn't have. And we impute motives to Israel that it doesn't have, like feeding people in Gaza. It doesn't want to feed people in Gaza. It wants to get rid of them one way or another. Now, that's very clear. We also impute motives to the Chinese that they don't have. And so we are, in a sense, fighting a series of delusions that we have created. These are paranoid, psychotic almost, distortions of reality. And I come back to the point that before Mr. Witkoff, the all-purpose envoy with a batting average of zero to date, we had Antony Blinken as the Secretary of State. He did not visit Israel once. I mean, not visit Moscow once. He never met with Sergei Lavrov, although he was absolutely sure what Lavrov wanted, even despite it never having talked to him. He met Lavrov only on the margins of international conferences for a few minutes. Lavrov has not been in Washington for 6 years. Mr. Witkoff has never met directly with Hamas. The only American envoy who did found Hamas to be quite reasonable and straightforward. Mr. Witkoff is clearly acting in a charade, not a serious negotiation. And Of course, Mr. Witkoff did meet with Iran, and he misled Arachi and set up a deception which led to the Israeli, the third Israeli attack on Iran. So what kind of diplomacy is this? Does Mr. Witkoff have any credibility with anyone except Mr. Netanyahu at this point? And I suppose President Trump as well.
You know, somehow, Ambassador, it's so amazing to me that Steve Witkoff, before these two attacks on Russia and Iran happening, he has left the scene. And he disappeared. And nobody, it was Rubio talking with Russians, if you remember. I asked him, what's happening to Witkoff? Where is Witkoff? And then we had the attacks on Russian nuclear bombers and the attack on Iran. And he came again to the scene and started. I don't know if these people in Russia and Iran would assume that he's serious in the way that he's behaving.
No, I suspect they don't see him as serious. They see him as a crony of President Trump. And they are observing President Trump in other contexts, not just in the bilateral context. Look at what he's just done in the economic trade policy arena. He's putting sanctions, tariffs on Brazil, but not orange juice, which is a big Brazilian export to the United States because Americans like to drink orange juice for breakfast. And this suggests that he actually understands at some level that tariffs are taxes on Americans, not taxes, not punishment of foreigners. Also, the facts on this, the excuse for doing this to Brazil is that he doesn't like the Supreme Court enforcing Brazilian law against his doppelganger, Mr. Bolsonaro. This has nothing to do with trade or economics or anything else. Fortunately for Brazil, only 12% of Brazil's exports go to the United States. So, if that number is reduced somewhat, it's not going to have a big effect on the Brazilian economy. Now we have him threatening Russia with secondary sanctions. This basically says, if you are, I'll use the example of India. If you're India and you buy oil from Russia, we're going to hit you with a 500% sledgehammer. So you're going to, all your exports to the American market are going to be cut off. This is basically the approach he tried with China. China was the only country that stood up to him, and it's now the only country that is coming out of this okay. The lesson is don't appease Trump, because if you do, he'll just ask for more. So then the question is, what will India do? What would Brazil do? I suppose Brazil might cut off our orange juice, and then we'd all suffer. And India would find ways to retaliate as well. There's no purpose in this. It is basically an expression of a foreign policy of diplomacy that is an extortion racket, that is bullying, that is inconstant. And by the way, there are no agreements in the trade area. We talk about agreements, but there's no paper. There's no text. There's nothing anybody agreed to. What there is a unilateral American statement. You agreed to this. Well, if you ask the Japanese, they say, actually, we didn't. A lot of that we didn't even hear about. We didn't know anything about. There's supposed to be, I don't know how much, $650 billion in Japanese investment in the United States. Well, it turns out that is just an invitation to the private sector to invest. But how can you invest in the United States when there's no reliable, predictable economic policy? I'll give you an example. The Ford Motor Company, which is the largest American manufacturer, in the United States of automobiles, produces 80% of its vehicles in the United States. If you're Ford, you want to build automobiles in the United States, you have to pay a 50% tariff for iron, steel, and aluminum, which are main components of autos. But if you import a car from Japan, you only pay 15%. So what this does, it helps Honda and Toyota and Subaru and Nissan and others, but it probably destroys the largest American domestic manufacturer. So what we're talking about is a set of policies which are not only coercive and which alienate everyone, we're burning bridges with everybody, not building them, but is irrational, arbitrary, capricious, and self-destructive. At what point do we have a counter-revolution? That is now becoming the question, because these policies are so damaging. And I say that to you, I know you are a Brazilian. Brazil has a history of doing terrible things to itself under military rule. I once said to you that I thought Trump is the Bolsonaro of North America. Maybe that's a better description than Bolsonaro being the Trump of the tropics.
Ambassador, before wrapping up this session, how do you feel about China and the way that they're trying to somehow diplomatically communicate with the United States, the way that they perceive the pressure from the United States? Here is what the U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said about China.
To the Chinese about Russian oil, did you tell them they're on notice, they need to start to pull back?
Well, we described, it's not just the president, what is making its way through the U.S. Senate, and you know, hard to imagine anything could get 80 or 90 bipartisan votes in the U.S. Senate, is a bill that will give the president discretion to apply secondary tariffs on sanctioned Russian oil from, I believe it's from 0 to 500%. I believe he's used 100%. And we've heard from several of our European counterparts, NATO allies, even Canada. Well, Canada is in NATO. That they will be following on that. So we would expect most of the Western alliance that has been supporting Ukraine to follow on that. So I think anyone who buys sanctioned Russian oil should be ready for this.
What was their response to that warning?
The Chinese take their sovereignty very seriously. We don't want to impede on their sovereignty, so they'd like to pay 100% tariff.
This is amazing reasoning. What we're talking about here is taking a sledgehammer to ourselves. The last time President Trump put 145% tariffs on anybody, China, the bond market went crazy. The Chinese stopped investing. Actually, I think they now have a rule that's being enforced by the National Reform and Development Commission, the NDRC, Development and Reform Commission, that will not approve major investments in the United States. The damage to U.S. consumers, to U.S. small businesses, the prospect of empty shelves at Walmart and other places was such that the Trump administration had to back off. Why do they think this would be any different? The only difference is that instead of just going after China, they propose to go after the world. This could cause, if it really worked, it would throttle the global economy. But more importantly, it'll throttle American trade and investment with the rest of the world. This is worse than isolationism. Isolationism combined a pretense of moral superiority with passivity. We would wring our hands and sit on them. We would not take any action in response to aggression by others, but we would condemn them loudly. And then finally, in the case of East Asia, we put sanctions on the Japanese to cripple their economy, and they responded by attacking us at Pearl Harbor. We got their attention. That's what sanctions accomplished. This is crazy. And the people that are pushing this legislation in the Senate are Lindsey Graham and Mike Blumenthal of Connecticut, so two senators. Both of them dyed in the wool neoconservatives. Both of them extremely ill-informed on international affairs. Both of them Zionists. Neither of them showing any concern for other human beings. And I think they disgrace our country rather than boost its power and influence.
So amazing to see that Donald Trump, considering all these conflicts, huge mess in Ukraine, in the West Asia, and he's seeking some sort of, he wants the Nobel Peace Prize, as they mentioned, they call it. I don't know if you saw the video, and the White House is talking about it. He deserves that. Here is what he said before wrapping up, Bassett.
Now ended conflicts between Thailand and Cambodia, Israel and Iran, Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, India and Pakistan, Serbia and Kosovo, and Egypt and Ethiopia. This means President Trump has brokered, on average, about one peace deal or ceasefire per month during his 6 months in office. It's well past time that President Trump was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize.
The guy is so selfish that he wants to conquer everything before leaving office.
Well, I think the fact is he brokered none of those agreements. The claim that he did has been derided by the parties. It particularly annoyed the Indians and Pakistanis, I think. Cambodia and Thailand had a mediation by Prime Minister Anwar of Malaysia, backed by the Chinese. The Americans were there. President Trump opportunistically pretended that he had brokered this. He didn't. I mean, he put pressure on both Thailand and Cambodia. You're going to get sanctions if you don't agree to peace. They agreed to peace, and he put sanctions on them anyway. This is not, I mean, how Ms. Leavitt could say that with a straight face, it's great testimony to her acting ability, I guess, but not to her veracity.
Thank you so much, Ambassador, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Well, it would be more pleasant if we had happy things to talk about. Yeah. But thank you.